Nazi Alvonin, so we speak about the Churban of the Gdol Yisrael, the Churban of the people that were the Teichnok, the Neshama Kla Yisrael. So we've spoken about a few of the people that were killed out in the last Churban. There's another Bechina of a Tzaddik. There's another Bechina of the Arz Elavonin. It says by Yitzchak Avinu that after the Akeda, he was considered Afrei Tzov Munach Tachas Kisar Kovet. Even though he was still living, he was Be'etzim a Sarov. His Be'etzim was a Kaddish. And he's seen as such, Kadosh Baruch Hu's Miyachat Shmoy, and so on. I wanted a little bit try to remember the Zeicha of somebody who was a Bechina of Afrei Tzov Munach, someone that survived the war, but was Kol Kulei, he was an ember. I want to think through a little bit the Ponevich Rav and the Erez Alavonin. He was Be'etzim destroyed. Be'etzim was destroyed in the war, and it was a pchina of Afa Tzav Munach, whatever he did afterwards. We'll talk about it. Ponevich Rav was born in 1886, approximately, in a small town called Kul. His name was Rabbi Yosef Shlomo Kahneman, and he was, from his early childhood, brilliant. He was tremendously, very brilliant, very sharp, very, very streetwise, big pikeach, molichein. He was called in yeshiva, it was called Yosha Kula, Yosha Yosef Kula from the town Kula. At a young age, he was off to yeshiva. His parents saw his geshoinus, and they sent him to yeshivas. He was in a few yeshivas, but his main two mekaymes that he would kaveya his dmus and his tzura was Tel's yeshiva, and Reb Lezer Gordon was his rabbi muvak in learning. That was his stam rebbe, was Reb Lezer Gordon, and he was by the Chavetz Chaim in Kol Kachim, and the Chavetz Chaim was the dmus that he saw in terms of Musar, in terms of the, like he once told over somebody something in Chavetz Chaim, and the person said, ah, das hat gesagt Chavetz Chaim said that? And he said, nein, das lebt der Chavetz Chaim. This is what the Chavetz Chaim lives. And the Chavetz Chaim was for him the demus, the Moira Derech, and the Moira Ra, for whatever he did, he would always ask himself, what would the Chavetz Chaim have said? Those are the two demuyos that formed his personality. He was a phenomenal masmid as a bacha. He was also somewhat mischievous, was involved in some things. In Yanim, and even when he was older, he would tolerate a child that was a little more mischievous and say, Yosha Kula was also once upon a time a live wire. But his smother was incredible, and he married a daughter of one of the great rabbanim in Litter, Rabbi Leibovil Kamira. And at the age of 25, 26, he took on, in 1911, he took on his first rabbanis in a small town called Vidge. It was a hamlet, literally. He was a rav for 3 years, and then World War I broke out. World War I destroyed the kehillahs in Europe, and he became, he stayed on, but there was nothing, it was charev. In 1918, he was asked to become Rav in Ponevich. Ponevich was one of the three big cities in Litter. It was Shavla, Kovna, Shavla, and Ponevich. And he became Rav in Ponevich in 1918. He was unique. He was someone whose breadth of vision was beyond anyone in Litta, probably beyond most people in Europe. The mentality in those days was to sit and be oisik in your local things and the passing your shilas, and that's it, and so on. He he started building almost the first day he came to Panovich. He built a yeshiva, and he built a yeshiva for young boys, and he built a yesemahiz, and he built a this, and he built a that. He, by the time the war came around, there were over 1,000 talmidim in his different maestas. It was a fanem, it was a scope of undertaking that was Litvish rabbanim, Litvish Jewry, and Litvish rabbanim beteva were very tsanua kind of. They didn't have the hoo-ha to deal with big things and big projects and undertakings. It was chalnat to them. And he had a vision that was incredible. He was the only city, between the wars, the matzav of Yiddishkeit and Litta went downhill rapidly. And in most big cities, the people were already, the majority of people were already not real shomer mitzvahs anymore. In Panovich, and there were splits in the Kehillah, the religious function of the rabbinate, and the chesed functions became more like what we would call federation-type organizations. The Rav didn't let that happen in Panovich. Panovich Rav kept all the maestas under his hanhaga. He cared as much for the chesed maestas as the Torah maestas, and the Torah maestas as the chesed maestas. He personally took care of everything. They found in the Pinkus Kehillah of Panovich a notation. This is typical. Such and such a person is in terrible need. The Rav and somebody else will go around from house to house collecting money. By Moaz Chitim, he would decide how much every person has to give, and he would post it up on the wall how much every person is supposed to give and how much he gave. And he held it was mutta and right to do. And nobody, once or twice people tried to bicker, and then they folded. He cared about every nidach and everybody needed something in Panovich. He cared about the next door. The door wasn't going to yeshivas anymore. There wasn't the musig of an institution where everybody would go to a cheder and then go on to yeshiva. There were yeshivas for mitzionim. The economics dictated that was the only thing. And he built up maestas. He found a way to people that were not frum. He was, in most places, the rabbanim either gave up, or they were loichim. He was the only one. One of his tchunas was, he had a tremendous warmth, and a tremendous ahava, that shone, that radiated from him, and a tremendous pikchus, and very even keeled, and with a sharp sense of humor. And he wanted the barbershop to close for Shabbos, so he would walk by, he put his head in and say, I couldn't Shabbos. And there was one who was insisted on keeping it open, so he sat down in the chair. And every customer came in, he wished him a good Shabbos. And that was the end of the customers, and that was the end, closed the store. This humorous way, one barber told him that he's going to the priest to Shmatzich. So, he's angry at him and he's going to go to the priest and become a Christian. So the Rav told him, until you don't bring me a certificate, they used to give certificates, I don't believe you. I'll keep wishing you good Shabbos. So he said, and when I bring the certificate, what are you going to wish me? So he said, good riddance. He had the sparkle that people loved him, and he used it. More than anything else, he began to go collecting money all over the world. And he needed, and there was no money in Europe. He tried in England and didn't go, and he tried in Europe. He wasn't getting anywhere. He started going to South Africa, eventually to America. Going to South Africa or to America in those days was a journey of weeks over 101 different ways. You got to take the coach to the train to the seaport to the ship to this place, then from that place to the other place. It was an undertaking. Very few people were interested in giving money. The people in America, and especially South Africa, had become distant from Torah. The music of Torah was alien to them. And it was very, very, very difficult to raise money, if at all. And upon which Rav went. And he went, and again. And he was gone. Most of the time he was wandering in all these places. As he wandered through South Africa, and then America, and other places, he began to see that Klal Yisrael is like the, it's like what we read in Yechezkel. It's sheep spread out. There's nothing. It's just about slipping away. And he would speak a lot more about Yiddishkeit than he would speak about money for his institution. He began somewhere long enough to realize HaKadosh Baruch Hu had sent him Nov and Nod to spread Yiddishkeit. He had tremendous koach hadibur. There were places where they didn't let him speak, and he would say, "I want to say three things, three words," and they'd be curious. And then he would make a joke, and they'd want more of it, and then he would win them in, because he was very, very, he was always drawing people in. He had a warmth and a chain and a sparkle. And he would talk again and again about Yiddishkeit. But more than anything else, he would tell the Rabbanim in South Africa, the Marshal, lost up the mikvois and the kashris und macht yeshivas. He said, if you want to save the dor, you need to have a yeshiva. They need to learn. They need to learn something. I was once speaking to Rabbi Aaron Kreis of Chayin of Racha. That's our Rabbi Kreis' father, Chayin of Racha. Rabbi Aaron Kreis' father was from the noted Masmidim of the Mir, from the big Masmidim of the Mir. And at Zikna Vatseva, he was a tremendous Masmid, tremendous Talmud Chochem. And he was, once he was in Eretz Yisrael, I met him, was in Yeshiva, we spoke and learning. Then I was standing in the back, Ben Astarim, and he said, I don't know how the conversation came to, but he was speaking about Avos HaTorah. So the first person that floated into his memory of a demus of Avos HaTorah was Rabbi Elchanan. He said, never was a time Rabbi Elchanan would miss a minute of a Seder. The Storim were fixed and set in stone. And he remembered, he said, Rabbi Elchanan once left to America for a year-long trip of fundraising. He said his coach was supposed to take him to the train station at 10 o'clock. He said at 9 o'clock he sat down to say this shir like regular. He said you couldn't notice a thing on him. He said the shir with the same galasnikite and the same ruikite of Elchanan was known for his calm and methodical and so on and so forth. At 10 o'clock, he finished, closed the Gemara. He said, I'll be gone till next year, Elul, and beginning of this month, and Agutin. That was it. And he said it over. And then all of a sudden, Rav Aaron Kreis's eyes misted. And he said, but the Panovich of Rav, when he got up, and he sort of imitated him, and I could see his eyes misting. It was very, he wasn't a... wasn't that type of person, Rabbi Aaron Kreiser. He was usually very kachadika, but his eyes misted, and he said, the Rav used to say, Brider, lerns, brothers, come, learn. And he said, the way in which that sucked up the people, you have no idea. He said, that's, to him, that Avos HaTorah, the expression of brothers, let's learn together, was... that to him, that was his the height of what he could picture as Avos HaTorah. And he would go from community to community, more often speaking about the younger communities, about Yiddishkeit, about Torah, about Klal Yisrael, about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Those were the things. In the 29 years that he was a Rav, by the time 1939 came around, he had built up a city that was L'Shem L'Seferis. It was, in a certain sense, the Frumster city in Litta. This was when Litta was going downhill. This was the city that had the largest spread of functioning Yiddishkeit. It had the most kids in Chinuch. It had Moistus L'Shem L'Seferis. It had a relationship, a community that functioned as a community, a tremendous Achdus, guided by the Murad Asra, in a way that was incredible. that was only shayach on the point of a Jerov, and he was in his early 50s in 1939, and it was Krause's achievement. His black beard had become gray and his hair white. It was a constant battle to keep building and to keep the mices going and to keep talking. And someone met him, and he told him, "Oi, Panovich Rov, er seid doch vergrößt geworden. Panovich Rov, you become white. Had you become white?" And in his humorous way, he said, "Von schwarze Arbeit." He said, "From black work, you become white." You know, he told him, you were black once, and I became so white. How did you become? He said, "Ich bin verschwarz geworden." He said, "Von schwarze Arbeit." But that's where he was. He had a family. He had a wife who was Rebbe Leibovitz Lekamir's daughter. He had his oldest son, Rebbe Avram, was a chashev, a younger man, a chashev, a bacha. He was married, chashev. But his pride and joy was a son named Yaakov, Yankale, who was a real ilui. And at the early age of 20s, 22, he went to Biskrov to learn. He was a off-the-books ilui, and he had his father's things. He had a little boy named Itzale, who was 10, 11, and a daughter, Esteke, who was a woman reflection of Panovich Rav. Every Maila Midatov that he had, she had as a woman. That's where he was in 1939. They began to sense that there's a war coming. It was obvious. And he said, they offered him visas from South Africa, and he said, the captain doesn't leave his ship. They offered his son, Yaakov, in America to come, and he said, he himself, the son, wrote that we are Bnei Litta, and we're Kigomel al Imoy. We're like children by a mother. We used a different type of anhaga. This is where we are. This is where we stay. And he stayed. In 1939, Germany and Russia split up Poland. And many of the Polish yeshivas ran away to Litta. We spoke about it when we spoke about Chaim Eise and Vilna. And a flood of Polish politim came to Litta. Litta was still an independent country for another year or so. And the Panovich Rav put all of his effort into finding food for all these refugees. Food and place. Thousands of people fought at a town that wasn't much bigger than them. And they needed, and he spent all his effort to make sure that they're holding on to them. In 1941, the communists took over. They invaded, the Germans invaded one end, the communists first invaded, they took over, and it was kind of an autonomous communist country. The government in Litta was at its wit's end what to do with all the Jewish refugees. They were very scared that somebody would use it as an excuse to invade them. The so-called Polish government, whatever it is, anything. And they told the Panovich Rav that he has to go to Washington. He had been in America, he had some connections, to be Poyel in Washington to bring in all the refugees, to let all the refugees, Jewish refugees, into America. They gave him a diplomatic passport. He was supposed to go with Kovner Rav. It didn't make any sense, but there was no Eitzah. They told him. They didn't give him a choice. They said, you have to go. And it was a threat of hope for everybody. And he set out to go. The Kovner Rav did not go in the end. Kovner Rav was too sick. He had cancer and he was dying and he didn't go. And he went himself. The goodbye, people sense the air. They didn't sense what's going to happen, but they're in for terrible times. And he asked, he made a drush, he said, it's 21 years that I've been Rav here. And I've, you know, if I owe anybody any money, if I'm left over any debts, he was always incurring terrible debts for the yeshiva and so on and so forth. I want to pay him now. He'd tell me right after Shabbos and I'll pay him and so on and so forth. And it was strange because he would be traveling. He was always traveling. I mean, he was never there. He was always going back and forth and never was a big commotion. This time, they took all the children from the cheder and the Beis Yisoyimim and all the children of town. They went to say goodbye. It was a very unusual moment. And as he's standing there looking around and all the kids of the town, the kids from the cheder and kids of Beis Yisoyimim and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids, maybe thousands, and one kid yells out, Nemer mit, take me along. And they all started chiming along, Nemtun's mit, Nemtun's mit. And all the kids in Panovich. And he said that's the memory. That's the memory that he carried till his last day. The children of Panovich begging Nememit. And that's what I meant. That it was Afrit Zavu Munach. He wasn't living his own life anymore. At the age of 52, 53, 54, that age approximately, he couldn't go to America directly. He went there to Israel. And he landed in Tel Aviv. He had an old mother lived in Tel Aviv and a brother. And his son had already made it to Israel. His son, from the older one, had been forced out because the army was after him to draft him. And he ran away and ended up in Israel. So he was there also. Panovrov landed in 1940 in Eretz Yisrael, and he realized the communists had taken over. There's no going back. There's Rommel was on the way to conquer Eretz Yisrael, and it was a moment in time that was as hopeless as could possibly be. There was nothing happening. The jaws. It's like watching your loved ones in the jaw of a shark and the jaw snapping shut and you can't do anything. Europe was closing in. The communists on one side, the Nazis on the other side, and it was crushing everything in between. Eretz Yisrael was about to be crushed. Apidar Hateva. Rommel was about to take that in. And there was a hope. And the Panovich Rav himself couldn't stay in Eretz Yisrael because the British had a thing about that anybody who comes to enemy country suspects means an enemy. So he might be a Nazi spy. There was the English, that was the cultured mindset. The Pikhim and the Chachamim and the civilized ones. So he was told that it's possible in Beirut he could possibly get a visa for himself and his family. So he went to speak to Rabbi Yaakov Halpern. Rabbi Yaakov Halpern was a big gvir who owned a lot of property in Bnei Brak area and so on. And he spoke with him about how to get the visas, how to get his own certificate to stay there because they're going to throw him out, and you know how you go to Beirut, whatever the plans they needed. As he walked out of the house. Of Rabbi Yaakov Halpern's house, he looked around. It was like there was a mountain. It was like a hill, and it was open space and very nice. And he says, "What a beautiful place! This is the place to build a yeshiva." And Rabbi Halpern told him, "You know," he said, "this is some of the most expensive property I have. It's beautiful property. It sort of overlooks. It's like close off to the ocean, and a big doctor wants to build here a sanitarium and so on." But I'll tell you what, if it's for yeshiva, I'll give it to you for 500 lirot, which was a very reasonable price. But tonight, it you start building within a year. So the Rav said, fantastic, deal. And that's it. The Rav walked out. And he met Rabbi Shaul Zolti, who was at, he writes a story. And he says, Skumpa Mazel Tov, I just bought a property for yeshiva. And Saul Zolti looked at him and looked at him and like, what are you talking about? You're homeless, helpless, a refugee without a place to be who's about to be expelled from here. Your wife, your children, your kehillah, all European Jewry is now caught in a trap. And it's crushing. And Eretz Yisrael is about to be invaded. And it's not going to be much better here. What are you talking about? He couldn't. And the Rav was somebody who Tanakh was always on his mouth. And he said, he said a parasha to him. Vayoyme Yirmiya, Hoya Dvar Hashem Elai Lema. There was a Dvar Hashem to me. Hine Chanamol Ben Shalom Doidech Boloch Lema Knea Sodeh Shabbat Nosses Kol Mishra Golos. You're about to be offered a piece of property in Anosses. And Chanamol came and he said, yeah, would you buy this? Ve'eknes Asod Mechanam. I bought it and I wrote a shtar on it. Ve'etne Seifa Makna Borok Ben Iriya. Now it's Moise the Seifa Makna. And I said, and so on. And then I said, then Yirmiyahu turns and he says, when I finished the deal, I wrote up the shtar, I gave it to Baruch for safekeeping, I turned to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And I said, Ribbono Shel Olam, Ata Hashem Elokim, Aho Hashem Elokim, Hine Ata Sisa Shemayim V'Aretz, and so on and so forth. Everything. And he goes through it. And he says, Klal Yisrael sinned. And they didn't do what they're supposed to do. Everything you said bad is going to happen. Is happening. Your nevuahs that you've given me till now are all being iskayim. Eretz Yisrael is about to be charev. Hine, hasoilois bo ha'ir. The ramps and batteries have come to the city Lelochta to capture it. They're there. The Bavlim are there, and they're setting up. And the city is about to collapse because everybody's dying of hunger, of disease, and by the sword. And everything you said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, HaKadosh said, came true. We see it. And you tell me I go buy a field bekesev, what are you talking about? The nevuahs that you sent me, Yerushalayim is going to be a charev of a city, desolate, nothing. It is going to be in the ground, and now you send me to buy a field. What does it mean? And that's what the Rav told him. He said, yes, the soil is a boy and this and that, and now I'm buying the field because there'll be a yeshiva here. And this is where Torah will come again. It was his hashkafa on everything, far, far ahead of everybody else. And the reason was because it came from there. He visited Reb Chatzkel Sarna once, when he that kufa, and Rev Chaskel said, "Oh, Panavitrov, what's Klal Teton? What do you think of doing here?" He said, "I'm building a yeshiva for 500 bachrim in Bnei Brak. There were not 500 bachrim all of Eretz Yisrael together learning at the time, let alone whatever was heaven this." And Rev Chaskel Sinai turned pale. And a look crossed his face. Oh my gosh, he snapped. He lost his family. He lost everything, and he's pashut not there. And the Panevijerov noticed it. He was a tremendous pekeach, and he grabbed Reb Chaskel Sinai's arm and he said, "Reb Chaskel, in 25 years from now, there will be not 1 million, not 2 million, more millions of people will be living here, and we won't have enough yeshivas for them." They asked him, what is he doing here? And he said, when they took out in the Asarugi Malchus, when they took out Reb Hananya ben Tradyan to be killed in Rapna Sefer Torah, so the Braisa says, they asked him, what did you see? And he says, Oisius Perchus Ba'avir. He said, the Gvilin of Europe are being burnt. The Gvilin of Europe are being burnt. The Oisius are Perchus Ba'avir. There's a world full of neshamis, of Torah, that's waiting to settle in on Gvilin. Our job is to prepare the Gvilin for them. But you can destroy the Gvilin, but the Oisius you can't destroy. The Oisius Peros Ba'avir, they stay, and they wait for Gvilin. What, how, when, we don't know. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu is burnt the Sefer Torah. Now we have to create a new Sefer Torah to write it down again. He spent the next 3-4 years. Within a year, he started building as the plan was, and it was in the hottest kufa. The dedication ceremony was him, Chazon Ish, and a few other rabbanim. Rabbi Yaakov Landau, the Rav of Neibrak, and a handful of people made no. They couldn't make any PR. It wasn't shayach. They put out a board with a piece of paper on it. That was the table, and they put a plate with some cookies, and a few bottles of soda. That was the Chanukah Sabayis, and not Chanukah Sabayis. It was the Chanukah Zevin Pina. And as the Panovijerov bent over to mix the cement and mix the cement and put it in, his body was racked by sobbing. He started sobbing, crying. And his tears went in. They said there was more tears than there was cement. And he finished it, pat it. And Chazon Ish turned to him and he said, Panovijerov, when you make a dedication with whiskey and cake, sometimes it's asliach, sometimes not. But when you dedicate something with tears, we have aftocha v'azerim b'dima b'rin yiktzeiru. There's aftocha v'David HaMelech that'll be matzliach. The next years, till 1945, 46, he spent. No one knew what was happening. They knew terrible things were happening. They kept hearing. No one knew where their family was. Nobody knew where their children were. Whoever was in Israel that had gotten out was in limbo. And he went from shtibel to shtibel, shul to shul, mokum to mokum. In every place he would speak, Ebi Mo'edet, and Chazik. There was, and they've written down many of it, there's just an innumerable amount. It was always... He walked in Tel Aviv to a shulchul, and they were sitting and learning daf hayomi. And he stood up and he said, no, I want to learn with you. He sits down with one of them, and when the Maggid Shir finished, after Meir, so the Rav started speaking, like, and everybody got around him. He was an enormous speaker. And he said, I thought I'm coming to be mechazik you. I got so much chizik. People work so hard, and you come on a blat gemara. And he spoke about the chshivas of it. And then he started speaking with everybody's heart. And he says, Gevald, where are we? We don't know where the brothers are, where the sisters are, where the children are, where this. And till everybody's crying. And he says, Tazlom ezong tilim, tazam. Let's say tilim. He says, David HaMelech says, Lulei soyroscha shashuai azavariti banyi. That the only thing to hold on to when things are impossible is tayyum. And that's what we're holding on to. And that's why it's so important. This was every place he went. His message was that without Torah, there's nothing to hold on to. He spoke someplace. There was once when he let his feelings come through, his personal feelings. He was speaking somewhere near Tel Aviv. I think it was the Groshul in the Yarkon. And then in the middle, he just burst into tears and he says, Rabbi Yisai, I can't help myself. He says, today is the bar mitzvah of my Yitzchak. And I don't know, is he not, where, what, when? He started sobbing. And then he said, no, it's not only my child. I have to think of many, many other children. I have to think of all the children. It's not right. The end of the war left him a person at the age of 55, 56, who had put in an entire life of work into building a family, into building into building a world up. The efforts that he turned white, the battles he fought, the buildings he built, the people he had, his kids, his community, everything. Everything was gone. It was like Eif. Nothing. A wind came and destroyed his entire life. And at the age, it's mid-50s, a destroyed life, Aleph Atov, an extraordinary full life, Aleph Atov, he needed to make a decision that he would start building again. His wife, who was a big tzaddikus, obviously, her name was Reb Tzefega, she said, an Ada said over that when they took them to be killed, with two things. First of all, they had made some ishtadlus and she with the kids could have been saved. And some bureaucratic snafu happened and it fell through. And when she heard that, she said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows whom to save. And when she was being led al Kiddush Hashem, and the Rav would say it over, she said, I'm so glad my husband Reb Yosh is out, because the world needs him so badly now. Very, very different way of looking at things. Panovitcher Rav started rebuilding. His vision and his vision and his ahava. It was today in Eretz Yisrael, the non-frum people, their attitude is live and let live. No, I just want to be left alone, let me do what I want to do, and that's it. That's kind of the main prevalent attitude. The attitude in those days was, let's teach them how to live. It's eis lasis. Let's pull the frum people in because we want to cut their payas and put them on shorts and show them what life is about and what Israel's about. It was very, very tough. And there's a letter from Rev Herzog, who's the who was the chief rabbi, and he was aligned. He was sort of a moderate in between, kind of. And a kid wanted to go Ein Charot. There were two kibbutzim, Ein Charot and Nahalel, were notorious for their anti-frumness and their the haches. And a kid was debating, a pullet was debating going there, and the Panovitcher and Rev Herzog writes him a letter, even I, when I walk into Ein Charot, I feel a kriris neira, I feel a terrible cooling of myself, my Yiddishkeit. Panovitcher Rav had a different look. Panovitcher Rav got up, there was an Aguda convention, sifa in Petach Tikva, and everybody was talking about the Tarav Matzim, Tarav Ruchnias, and that. And the Panovitcher Rav said, we need to prepare tefillin and mezuzahs for the kindlach of Ein Charot and yeshivas for the kindlach of Nahalel. People didn't know what to make of it, but he said it, he swept everybody up. And there was a shul open up recently in Ein Charot. There were people started becoming frum. It was a vision of Netzach Yisrael that was bigger than everybody's vision, because he saw Klal Yisrael b'toivasei. He once said, Yisrael k'doishim, there's kachim that became tamei, and there's kachim that yotza chutza. There's all sorts, but the Shem kachim stays, because that's kodesh. And he began looking at Eretz Yisrael with eyes of building and so on. There was another tchuna of the Panavidja Rav that makes him stand out extraordinary. People who had to cope emotionally with what he had to cope with, the sight of hundreds of children saying Nemich Mit, Nemtun's Mit, the memory of a wife, the memory of children, the memory of a city, of a town, of a country, many of them closed themselves off emotionally. Many of them just stopped feeling. In other words, they acted kind of mechanically. That was one way of coping with it. So you don't get in touch with your feelings. You don't. There was gedolim that wouldn't kiss a child, touch a child, because they couldn't. It brought back searing memories. They couldn't do it. And they. Panavidja Rav exuded. It's as if he gathered all the warmth that had been burnt and projected it. The first thing he built was an orphan home for children. He called it a base office. He says, it's not a home for children. It's a home for us to be fathers. Every bacha that he took in, every person he came in contact with, he exuded a tremendous amount of ava. It's almost as if all that feeling and all that regish became projected in that. Reb Lezal Pachinsky was, very, very short, and he was a bacher in Panevich, and he was laying on a bench one evening, he was sort of going to sleep, and the Panevich Rav was standing with Reb Abba Grossbart, who was the Mashgiach, and they didn't notice he was laying on the bench. He was kind of small, and it was kind of dark. So he overheard the conversation that he probably wasn't supposed to be. And Rabbi Grossbart had lost his family in the war, never could remarry. Just emotionally, he couldn't. He was a withdrawn person, big tzaddik, big Adam Kasha, but that was it. And he was standing with the Panavidja Rav, and he told him, Panavidja Rav, vitutid us. How do you do it? I can't. How do you deal with your emotions? And the Rav said, Ich farboidas. I build with my emotions. I channel it into building it. Every child that I take in and that I give him love and warmth and embrace and care, that's what I do with it. And there was something that was extraordinary. It was something that Bederach Kalal, a person who's not a sensitive person, not an emotional person, can deal with things, you know, so it's not, but somebody who's so sensitive, so his emotions are so powerful, and able to deal with it, that was what the Rav did. The Rav spent 29 years in Rabbanis. In 29 years in Rabbanis and Panevich, at Panevich and Vich together, and 29 years in Eretz Yisrael. It was HaKadosh Baruch Hu had been macher of an entire world, like Eiv, almost like Eiv. And he picked himself up and rebuilt a world. He built every maaser under the sun possible. And he was already an older person now, physically not well. He, in his first year in Eretz Yisrael, he lost his voice. He went to a doctor, and that doctor said, you have cancer in the throat, and you have a year to live. And he started making plans, who should take over, and who should take over a yeshiva that didn't exist. Take over, and who should take care, and who should this, and who should that. And then a year later, they decided he made a mistake. It was not that. But he lived like that. He became very sick in Europe. He was in America, and he became very sick. His kidneys failed, and they had to do a very difficult operation to remove a kidney. A second time, he had a clot in his foot that they said they needed to amputate. Baruch Hashem, they didn't. And he knew pain and suffering all his years. It was mamash a life of Eiv. The one thing that wasn't Eiv was his face, his voice, his warmth, his embrace, and everything. And he left us with some hashkafis. He left us with hashkafis about the war. No one can say hashkafis about what happened, except for a person who was there. And one hashkafa was, he brought a pasuk someplace that it's called a Yom HaGadol. And he said, why is it a Yom HaGadol, a day of Churban? So he also said over a perek in Yecheskel. He says, L'chein emar l'bneis is beis Yisrael, koyam ha'ashem l'kim. Ha'bederach ha'vaisechem atem nitmim, v'achay shikotzeem atem zaynim. Are you following the reserves of your forebears? Uv'seis matnaisechem ba'av v'bneichem ba'eish atem nitmeisem ha'givleichem ar'ayoyim. V'ani adorash l'chem beis Yisrael. I'm going to look after you, Kal Yisrael. Chayo ninum ha'ashem l'kim im adorash l'chem. That which you think would happen, that you would become Oibda Vedazura, it'll never happen. That which you say that you're going to become like the Goyim, that will never happen. And if you don't do tshuva, chaya ninum Hashem alekim. If I won't unleash every power in the Bria to force Malchus Shemayim on you, I'll take you out from the Amim, and I will take you out from all Zerotzes. I will take you out with an outstretched hand and with a horrendous anger. And I will bring you to Midbar Amim, v'nishpati itchem sham. So the Panav Rav said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has taken Klal Yisrael out. Gather them, it's mamish, into the ghettos, into the concentration camps, and made a mishpat between them and Umas Olam. But there's two more words in the pasuk. V'nishpati itchem sham panim el panim. The only other time Moshe Rabbeinu is panim el panim, and when HaKadosh Baruch Hu is yoyim chemosh fucha, is moilech biat chazaka, and Klal Yisrael, it's a yoyim of panim el panim. Panim zoyafois, but it's panim el panim. That's what someone who lived it, that's Arzi Alvonin, who saw in the chemosh fucha, Yad Hashem, he saw yoyim godol v'noira, because it's a day of panim el panim. Someone asked him, doesn't it say Malachim? It says when they took Rabbi Akiva, the Malachim was Zoyek. Malachim Mar Yevkoyun, you know, Zutarev Zuschara. And the Panavid Rav said, Malachim ask Shilas, Yidin don't. It's the Gmail of Klal Yisrael. And finally, one last point that he said. Someone asked him, someone met him, and he said, Panevijarov, Zuck me the members, tell me the truth, Panevijarov, don't you have kashas? And he said, I have only one big question that I really struggle with that I haven't answered yet fully. And the question is, why did I remain? Am I fulfilling the tachlis? If HaKadosh Baruch Hu took me out from there, did I fulfill the tachlis? I didn't get out because of my schusim. I got out because of what I expected to do. And he said, that's the question that I don't have a good answer for yet. he brought a medrash also, it says, but the Aaron and Noisarim, that they themselves also should have been destroyed by Kadosh Baruch Hu's Richem al Aaron. That was the Arzei Levonim. That was the Hashkafa. That was the life they lived. And his personal Gehenim lasted 30 years. He was nifted in 69. And from 39 to 69, he lived with the memories of his wife, of his children, of the children of the town, of the people, of the Litvische Yidentum. He had a tremendous ava. And for Klal Yisrael, he lived with those memories. It was 30 years he lived with having to start from the bottom when he was at the top and built. But it was always with a happiness, with a warmth, with so much chen and chias. If you look at a picture of the Panovitcher Rav, it jumps at you. There's the worn out, the face that has deep ridges, the toil, the eyes that sparkle with chachma, and the smile and the warmth that almost leaps out when you see it. I want to finish with one. The bracha that a kohen makes by Berachas Kohanim is Asher Kitshon Mitzvoisov Mitzivona Levorach Es Amo Yisrael Bi Ahava. Kedushas Kohen is Ahava. The Rav, because of who he was, because of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu had put him through, is probably the dogma of the Kedusha of Ahava. An Ahava that comes because he sees past the chutz. Where everybody else saw angry faces and mocking youth, he saw neshamas that are someday going to want talis and tefillin and learning. He saw that the Yiddish neshama wants to learn, and that no matter wherever there is, he embraced Klal Yisrael Brider with real sense of that. And if a Brider, then what more could I want for you than to learn? That was the Kedusha and the Ahava, and the Kedusha of Ahava, that this particular Arzei Levonim that suffered 29 years of burning gave over to us.